Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 30. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a bit of a nostalgia fest. I'm looking at all of the genre media that I enjoyed as a child, just having a little bit of a name check and a little bit of a chat about them with myself. No guests this time around, which is okay because I've got something big lined up next time around. So sit back, relax, grab a pen and paper because I'm going to be looking at 1960s children's television media type stuff and probably making a certain amount of the listenership feel either very old or very young. So I'll get the contact details out of the way and then I'll get into doing some deep, dark nostalgia. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the voicemail line, which is 206-337-5398, and that's recent. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, I hope everybody's doing well. We're doing fine here. The weather is starting to turn cooler, which I don't particularly enjoy, as long-time listeners will know. But it's inevitable, and what can you do about it except go somewhere tropical, which I can't afford to do right now, which is a shame. Yeah, I've been watching a few things media-wise. Of course, the usual suspects, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., A Person of Interest, and things like that. On the comedy side of things, I'm getting into watching Kroll Show with Nick Kroll, which is a lot of fun. If you have that around, I recommend it. It's pretty silly, but a lot of fun anyway. So, what have I been watching as far as cinema is concerned? I'll just bring up the Letterboxd and we'll have a look. I did see a mockumentary kind of thing called CSA, Confederate States of America, which is kind of like a documentary from an alternate universe where the South won the Civil War in the US. And to be really honest with you, things don't go particularly well for people of colour, let's say. But it's a 2004 documentary. I recommend it if you can find a copy of it. It's not mind-blowingly, fantastically, over-the-top wonderful, but it does give a perspective on a very bleak part of US history. So from that point of view, it's a watcher. Let me see. I'll just talk about the genre stuff. I won't go into the other stuff. I'll save that for Paleo Cinema. I did look at Phantom of the Paradise, Brian De Palma's movie from 1974, because Liz Travascus and I discussed it on ABC local radio Darwin, and I'll add the audio of that discussion to the end of this podcast. Yeah, it's a bit of fun. It was nice to revisit it. Love the soundtrack. Really cool stuff. And I think I liked it a bit more than Liz did, but you can judge yourself when you listen to that audio. The only two other really memorable things from a genre point of view that I've watched were Gravity. I saw that yesterday. And Technically Spectacular. They really give a feel of what it is like in space, in near-Earth orbit. Yes, and Sandra Bullock does what's expected of her, but no more in the main role. George Clooney's in there as support. From a technical point of view and from a space geek point of view, it was great, but it's a very simple and very linear plot. And I can't help but think that the characterization is a bit thin. Little hard to do with almost a single hander, I realise, but there is something a little bit lacking in that, which I haven't heard other people mention. But from a technical point of view, and from a point of view of giving a viewpoint of people in space. Really, really top stuff. And it also highlights the problem we have with space junk at the moment. All we need is one thing to go wrong and you get a cascade effect, just like in the movie. And a lot of our satellite communication gets 86'd for the next 20 years. So it is something that we've got to be careful of. We don't just need to worry about pollution down here, but we need to worry about pollution up to and including about 40, 50,000 kilometers out. So from that point of view, it was good. I did watch something that was really, really bad. The 100th movie I've watched this year. I watched the really cheap and nasty and dumb version, the second Atlas Shrugged movie based on the Ayn Rand novel. I saw part one a couple of years ago. Part two came out and it's abysmally bad, as indeed the Razzie Awards last year indicated. It's the kind of thing that only somebody who's a contributor to Fox News could really enjoy. In fact, Sean Hannity does a cameo on it, which shows you the kind of ratiocination that the producers and writers had for this film. It's a movie by people who've never really watched a movie. Incredibly bad. But I'm going to watch number three when it comes out, because it's a bit like you've got to do it. Yeah, it's bad. Yeah, the philosophy behind it is repugnant and doesn't relate at all in any way to what we know of human nature and human society. But it's like a slow motion train wreck. You can't tear your eyes away from it. And slow motion train wrecks are very apt simile there, because a lot of this movie takes place on choo-choo trains. But yeah, I don't recommend it. But if you're in the mood for being appalled philosophically and politically, then go ahead and enjoy Atlas Shrugged Part 2. The weird thing about these movies is they're doing the couple of years apart. So Atlas Shrugged Part 1, Atlas Shrugged Part 2, Part 3. They're recasting every single actor in the movie, each different movie. So the characters don't even look alike. It's just an incredible balls up. And of course, I know the reason they're doing that. That way they don't have to increase the amount they're paying the actors each movie. And these things are running around a budget of $15 million, probably played for by the Koch brothers. But yeah, I've talked way too much about a movie that I don't like. So don't recommend it. But if you want to indulge, I recommend downloading it. And that way the market has its say. There is some upcoming media that's kind of cool. Captain America the Winter Soldier comes out in a couple of weeks, and I'm looking forward to getting my Marvel freak geek on doing that. So that's definitely a must see in the first week, and I'll let you know what I thought of it when I have watched it. I love the Marvel Universe. I love the way they're going about it. The way they're doing it pretty much is two movies a year. The first one is a sequel to a previously released movie, so you've got that lead film to take you into the first movie they do of the year. And the second one expands the universe. In this case, in 2014, it's going to be the Guardians of the Galaxy, which I've already waffled enough about previously on the podcast. And that's kind of cool, because it means that either 2016 or 2017, I get my Doctor Strange movie. Quite pleased with that, because I am looking forward to Doctor Strange turning up in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I think that's quite a good way of doing it too. You bring people in with the first film of the year, then the second film of the year kind of dilates it all into a wider universe. And that's a very good way of doing it. I'm reading a book at the moment called Blockbusters, which is about how blockbusters of various kinds, both in cinema and in other pop media, music for instance, how the studio system basically invests most of its marketing budget in the enormously large tentpole movies, and why they do that. The reason basically is that the odds favour a certain percentage of tentpole movies each year. The really big ones will be enormously successful, make over $1 billion. So as far as the marketing and publicity budget's concerned, it makes sense for a studio to invest overwhelmingly most of their publicity budget in these big tentpole films, and rather than pressing for smaller films to that won't make as much money, even if they are successful and they cost $30 million to make, at most you're going to make another $70 million on that. But if you invest the marketing budget into a large blockbuster film that costs you $200 million to make, then your possible rewards are something like $800 million to $1 billion for putting the money into those ones. So studios, for that reason, just purely playing the odds, put a lot of their marketing into large blockbuster movies that hit all of the different marks, which is they've got to be popular with young people and old people and with men and women. So, and the Marvel ones hits that sweet spot very well. They've got the eye candy of the cute guys and the cute women. They've got the geek cred of just comic book fans who are incredibly and overwhelmingly popular. Well, not popular, but numerous. And people who liked the comics when they were kids in the 50s and 60s will come to the movies, as well as people who are 15 to 40-year-old comic geeks now. So it hits all of the sweet spots from this blockbuster point of view. And I can see there will maybe successes and failures in the future for Marvel, but I think overwhelmingly their business plan really works well, and the entertainment value of what they produce also works very, very well. So on to the stuff I consumed as a child in the realm of genre media. There were some Australian bits and pieces as well as overseas ones at the time. Now, I'm not going to talk about them because I've just decided in the future Martian Driving podcast, I'm going to talk a little bit about Australian science fiction television. There's not an incredible amount of it, but what there is kind of interesting. I think it deserves its own episode of the podcast, so I'm shelving that one for now, and I'm going to talk about the overseas stuff that I consume. Now, there were other things, but I'm just talking about the stuff that was on my radar. I didn't watch Doctor Who when I was a kid, for instance, but there were a number of other things that I did. So it's a very subjective and very personal viewpoint this time around, but it does give you a bit of an idea about how far we've come since those days in children's television, particularly the nuanced and complex world of Adventure Time being a prime example of that. Even though it's a very crudely drawn animation series, there are a lot of complex characters in it, and it tells some interesting morality tales in a much less simplistic way than the stuff I consumed as a kid did, where everything was kind of like bipolar. There was good versus evil. There wasn't any nuance in it, but Adventure Time's very different from that. And that's the reason why my nephew Billy, who is turning 4 on Monday, is getting a box set of Adventure Time for his birthday. So allowing for the fact that things were simpler and more naive in those days, one of the interesting things that occurred was that, I'm talking about the mid-1960s now, and this pissed off relatives. I think I've mentioned it once before in a Paleo Cinema podcast. This really pissed off older relatives. The fact that in the mid-1960s, when I was starting to become a voracious consumer of televisual media, some products started coming out of Japan, which was really, really popular with kids, and a certain amount of the grown-ups disliked it. We were being rebellious by liking something from a culture with whom we were at war a mere 20 years before. And that is a lot of stuff which we now call anime, but which at the time was just called cartoons. And there were a number of them. I'll just do a little montage of the kind of stuff that I was consuming in the mid-1960s and thoroughly enjoying.
Changing wrong. Prehistoric monster who came from outer space, created by the Martians to destroy the human race. The FBI is helpless, it's 20 stories tall. What can we do? Who can we call? Call for war, the ape man. Call for war, the ape man. Faster than a rocket, faster than a jet.
Here he comes, here comes Speed Racer, he's a demon on wheels. He's a demon and he's gonna be chasing after someone. He's gaining on you, so you better look alive. He's busy revving up the powerful Mach 5.
So thinking it through, we have a story about a robot who was copied from a dead boy. We have another one about a kid from outer space who comes to Earth and misses his mum. We've got a third one about a kid who uses a giant robot as a drone. We have another one about a cop who gets killed and his brain gets put into a robot body, shades of RoboCop. And we have a really weird anime about a kid who races cars. All of this stuff was mind-blowing for us in those days and, as I said, pissed off certain parents. But there were things that we weren't seeing otherwise. We'd already lived through a bunch of different media, but this was the first really solid genre stuff that was on at a kid-accessible hour on Australian television. Yes, there were Twilight Zone and Star Trek and The Outer Limits, but only rarely was I able to see them. When I was staying at my grandparents' place, and my uncles lived with my grandparents at the time, and my uncles would let me stay up and watch occasional episodes of The Outer Limits late on a Saturday night, and those sort of things. But this stuff was at a kid-accessible time, on in the afternoons, and it came from a different culture. It came from a culture which had basically been conquered by the Americans 20 years before and had its own cultural tropes. The animation was very simplistic because to make the animation cheaper, there were fewer frames per second, which gives that early anime that really weird look that it had. And a lot of them were based on manga because it wasn't expensive in the post-war Japan to make manga. I mean, printing cartoons was a lot easier than a lot of other things people did. I mean, you've got Astro Boy, which originally came out in 1952, only 7 years after the war, as Tetsuo and Atom, the Mighty Atom. And I can see how just after the war, the story of somebody who resurrects their child as a robot could have a certain resonance with people in Japan, given the Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and of course the firebombing of Tokyo. There were cultural resonances there, a bit like there are in the original Gojira. There are things there that are specific to the recent memories of the Japanese people. And Astro Boy is very much a part of that. And, of course, Astro Boy has been rebooted a couple of times since then, in the 80s, and I think towards the millennium as well, and still has that great cultural cachet. You can still get tons and tons of Chan figure Astro Boy stuff around Chinatown here in Melbourne, for instance. And it's had an incredibly long life for reasons of nostalgia, essentially. Then you've got Prince Planet, which came in the mid-1960s. Of course, a lot of these things were prepackaged by American companies who grabbed the Japanese anime, dubbed them, and packaged them for distribution in America and of course, Australia and a number of other countries as well. And Prince Planet was pretty weird and stylish. It got better as it went on in the series. But basically, the Federation of Planets sends a kid with a power pendant to Earth to help us become able to be a member of the Fellowship of Alien Species or whatever it was. And one of the things that Prince Planet really wants is he misses his mum. So there's a lot of missing my mum stuff in there as well, which is kind of odd, but the cool theme song and a lot of the villain characters, particularly Craig of Cragmire, who was very, very cool, engaged our attention at the time. And this is also the time when we were watching kind of non-genre stuff like The Samurai, Shintaro the Samurai TV series was incredibly big in Australia. It was bigger than The Beatles at one stage. And there are other series as well, Phantom Agents, which was about a bunch of ninja secret agents in 20th century Japan. That was fairly big in Australia as well. So we were very immersed in kind of pan-Pacific culture between America, Japan, and Australia. We were covering all of the waterfronts of Australian media at the time, but this was something that of which parents weren't particularly aware, but kids definitely were. Then, of course, you've got Gigantor, which was based, again, on manga, Tetsujin 28, manga released in 1956. So there's a lot of 1950s culture reappearing as cartoons in the 1960s. And there was even a couple of live-action films based on Tetsujin 28, one of which I've seen a few years ago. I probably have a copy of it here somewhere in the archive, but I haven't watched it for a while. That is Australia in 1968. Meanwhile, we also got some weirder stuff like Johnny Socco and His Flying Robot, which was a live-action series, not entirely dissimilar to Gigantor. We got a lot of weird media in those days. And then, of course, anime is still very, very popular in Australia. I went to the Mad Men warehouse sale last year, and the biggest selling DVDs and Blu-rays at the warehouse sale were anime, modern anime, but there's a continuum there from those of us who were kids in the 1960s to people who are teenagers now and are totally getting off on more recent anime. We kind of blazed the trail there with that stuff that, which was only ever available on TV, because of course all this stuff predates any kind of recordable video media. So we were kind of geared to accept cultural differences in a lot of ways to an extent greater than any generation that preceded us. The generations that preceded us had a very kind of Anglo-centric viewpoint. But for us, we were just starting to diversify a little bit and accept and embrace difference. And of course, that is never a bad thing. When I think back on it, really, the 1960s were an incredibly pop culture-rich time. You had your James Bond craze and the spy craze that followed that. Right at the start of the 1960s, westerns were incredibly big and popular, and kids were watching those as well. Then you roll in all of this Japanese stuff, and just that explosion of media, which compared to the explosions of media we have now, were a mere trickle. But at the time, they were ubiquitous and really did have a big influence on the way that we saw the world. We saw the world through the lenses of James Bond and the Avengers, the TV series, of course, with Patrick McNee, Honor Blackman, and Diana Rigg. We saw it through the lenses of weird things that were kind of right on the fringe, like Peter Stuyvesant television commercials in cinemas before the movie, where there'd be really cool-looking people water skiing in the south of France and then smoking cigarettes. So all of this stuff blended together to give it, to shape the way we saw the world at the time. And then you have the influence of Jerry and Sylvia Anderson.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Thunderbirds are go.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquerors of the sky.
my heart would be a fireball, a fireball. Every time I gazed into your starry eyes.
So Gerry Anderson came along, and Sylvia Anderson, of course, came along and combined puppetry with state-of-the-art model making, and that was the sweet spot in the 1960s. The fact that not only were the, you know, you could forgive the being able to see the strings on the marionettes and all that kind of thing, because the model making was fantastic. The Thunderbirds and Supercar, Fireball, XL5, all the way back to Torchy the Battery Boy in the 1960s were the best of the best. They really did take meticulous care in how they designed things, and they were kind of on the forefront of groovy design all the way through the live action stuff that the Andersons began to make in the 1970s, like UFO and Space 1999. They really did have a look about them and a kind of sanitized, gleaming future, which, of course, never happened because the future, suddenly cyberpunk came along and the future had to be grungy. But they did have something that wasn't available to on adult television, really. And, of course, UFO and Space 1999 were ostensibly for adults, but what they really were the people who had been kids when the Super Mario Nation stuff was on. That's the target audience, I think, for UFO and Space 1999, was the people who had grown up with Gerry Anderson were now adults and wanted to continue the relationship in some way. And, of course, time and taste superseded him. There were a number of other TV series like Terrorhawks, which is harking back to the Super Mario Nation days, that didn't really work. And then, of course, about 10 years ago, there was the really shitty movie version of Thunderbirds, which didn't work very well. But the more I think about it, the more I see a link between the media we consume as children and the movies that are becoming very popular in our adulthood. There is a causal link there. I'm talking about popularly. I'm not talking about people who grew up in abusive relationships going on to see Lars von Trier movies. I'm talking about the big blockbuster films, and the very phenomenon of blockbuster films directly relates to the fact that we saw very cool things when we were children, and we come to expect that at a certain level from the media we consume now. So in a real sense, the media I watched when I was a kid, particularly the genre media, is the seed from which my interests that I have now has grown. And that's kind of cool too. As long as you're watching the right thing, I would hate to think what would happen to children. And this is interesting. There was a news article today saying that the most popular show among kids in Australia is a reality TV cooking program. Now, I find that repugnant for a couple of reasons. The first one being that cooking shouldn't be a sport. It's more of an art. And I hate TV shows that take everything to the level of a sport. It just doesn't sit well with me. I'm not a sports-oriented person. I think that some things should be what they are and not have people try to transmogrify them into something they're not. So what are those kids going to really grok on when they're adults? Are they going to be elaborate billion-dollar movies about cooking? I really don't understand that mentality. It's anathema to me. Of course, the other argument is that that's not the only thing they're watching, and they are watching other things as well. But I do like the fact that there's a good start in life if you're introduced to a wide range of things, particularly in the recreational things that you do, whether it's a whole bunch of different sports for people who are sports-oriented, whether it's a whole bunch of different media for people like me who are media-oriented. Getting that diversity is really important. I think the fact that I did see a lot of stuff that came from other cultures was of great benefit to me. I haven't kept up on anime in particular. I did have an indulgence 10 years ago with Yu-Gi-Oh! The original series, because it grabbed my attention. I kind of liked it, and I liked the drama of it, and I liked the world that it created. So there is that part of things, but I still have an appreciation for it, which is kind of cool. In fact, I'm looking up now, and I'm in the man cave here. I looked up now, and I've got a big model of the original Speed Racer Mark V with a Speed Racer in it, sitting up in the original box, up above the shelf that holds my television DVDs. So that's kind of cool. And I look over to my left, and there's my plastic Yu-Gi-Oh! Mask looking back at me. I'm surrounded by this shit. It's no wonder I talk about it. But getting back to the childhood stuff, there are TV shows that I really enjoyed as a child that I find myself now unable to be enthusiastic about. And they're all produced by the same guy. At the time they came out, when I was quite young, they were the best stuff on television as far as I'm concerned. But now, in retrospect, and having seen them again in years not long past, I kind of wonder whether I have been eating paint chips. And they're the TV series produced by Irwin Allen. I'm talking about things like Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, The Time Tunnel, Lost in Space, Land of the Giants, those sorts of things. They were really, really dumb, and they haven't got better with age. There have been documentaries done to try to whitewash his career and to say that these things are lost nostalgic gems and good science fiction and all sorts of other things like that. But the truth is they're pretty piss poor and ordinary when we look at them again. The plots are trite and stupid. They talk down to kids. The science in them, even though they're ostensibly science fiction, is woeful, if at all there is any. And the acting is marginal. It's one of those things that hasn't aged well at all. There are a number of series that have aged beautifully well, but the science fiction, in inverted commas, of Irwin Allen really hasn't done so. I think that they went cheap. Things like The Time Tunnel, the use of stock footage was ridiculous, and they didn't really try very hard to make the thing work. Every episode was pretty much the same as the one before it, except with different costumes. And even though I did enjoy them at the time, I wasn't passionately fanatical about them, but I really did enjoy them at the time. I think it was because I was an ignorant little kid and there wasn't anything else. And that's one of the unfortunate things about it, is that while you will watch shit when you're a kid because there's nothing better on, you could either watch sport, which I wasn't particularly interested in watching. There were some spy TV shows that I did watch, but because you were locked into a specific time to watch this stuff, you watched it because it was on and it was your time to watch television. And that's the problem. They had a captive audience and they mistreated it to a big extent, and I find that quite rude and nasty. They got some really good character actors in Kirk Kasner, for instance, in Land of the Giants. Great character actor. He was in Kiss Me, Kate, and he did a lot of good stuff on the stage, but it's one of those jobs you take when you're an actor of a certain age and you want to make a bit of money before you retire and that kind of stuff. But yeah, the Irwin Allen stuff really doesn't age well. I've got a little bit of it here on the shelf, but it's not something I revisit very much. And by the way, the music is by John Williams, a guy who then went on to do stupid things like Star Wars, about which I won't talk because I detest Star Wars at the best of times. But yeah, Irwin Allen, not so much. But there were other things that I did enjoy. And some of the Hanna-Barbera cartoons of the time were pretty damn cool. In fact, in The Glass Teeth, his work on television in the 1960s, Harlan Ellison, again a person who has a checkered career and a reputation for bombast and fulmination, mentioned how groovy some of these cartoons were, and they were. There were some really, really good cartoons in the 1960s. My all-time favourite, of course, and I have said this before on the podcast, is this one.
Somewhere out in space live the Herculoids.
Igu, the giant rock ape. Tundro, the tremendous. Bloop and Bleep, the formless, fearless wonders. With Xandor, their leader. And his wife, Tara, and son, Dorno. They team up to protect their planet from sinister invaders. All strong, all brave, all heroes. They're the Herculoids.
This has got to have the simplest plot on television. Basically, the Herculoids, Xandor, Tara and Dorno, their planet, they're living on a planet together, a family and all of these great big aliens. And every episode, another alien species comes and invades the planet. And then they beat them off and defeat them. That's it. That's all that ever happens in one of these things. It's 25 minutes long. And all of them are the same, but they find new ways of doing it every time. And it's just a lot of fun there. And the concepts are great. You know, the giant rock ape and Tundra who shoots energy rocks out of his horn. And two blob-like entities, Gloop and Gleep, and Zok the laser dragon. It's just really cool concept, and it kind of ran really well. In fact, they did a remake of it in, I think, the 80s or 90s, which didn't work very well, but of its time, in its time, it was a very, very cool show. And there were other cool shows as well. Some of them were, of course, Hanna-Barbera, like the Herculoids, for instance, this one. Yeah, of course, that was Hoyt Curtin's music from Johnny Quest. Terrific adventure series for kids. It was remade again in the 90s, but the original is fantastic and inspired a whole bunch of things, including my favourite animated series of current times, The Venture Brothers. Johnny Quest and his friend Haji and their dog Bandit go off on adventures with his scientist father, Dr. Benton Quest, and their minder, Race Bannon. Interesting thing about Race Bannon, I put a few things about him up on Facebook, and apparently Race Bannon, the kind of polo shirt-wearing guy with the prematurely grey hair, is a gay icon among certain of my friends. Now, I don't know why. Maybe it's the kind of same way that Jeff Chandler was a gay icon. But one way or the other, Race Bannon apparently is a gay icon. And there it is. But Johnny Quest, terrific adventure stories set all around the world. Good monsters, terrific special effects. And even though they were using limited animation, it really does kick ass and was a lot of fun. The other company doing good work along those lines, apart from Hanna-Barbera at the time, was Filmation, who did some really nice TV series. People remember them most for things like He-Man and She-Ra. and the animated Star Trek series from the early 1970s, but they did some cool stuff around 68 as well, including this one, which I kind of like. This is the introductory narration by Ted Knight, who people remember from the Mary Tyler Moore Show and also from Caddyshack.
Headquarters! CMDF, Combined Miniature Defense Force. Project
Fantastic Voyage.
Process Miniaturization. Authority Top Secret, Highest Clearance. Team Jonathan Kidd, Commander. Guru, Master of Mysterious Powers. Erica Lane, Doctor, Biologist. Busby Birdwell, Scientist, Inventor, Builder of the Voyager. Mission, in their miniaturized form, to combat the unseen, unsuspected enemies of freedom. Time limit,
12 hours.
That one, of course, was a kind of sort of spin-off variation on Fantastic Voyage, the 1966 movie starring Stephen Boyd and Raquel Welch. But it had its own kind of coolness. I was trying to find out who did the music for that, but I wasn't able to. IMDb doesn't say who did the music for Fantastic Voyage, but there's a kind of cool, tense grooviness about it that I really like. And the other thing I should mention about the Hanna-Barbera stuff is fantastic sound effects in them, the monster sound effects in the Hanna-Barbera series, and the mechanics and the laser beams and the ray guns and the ships and everything were fantastic and really top-notch stuff. And they had their own house style, which really added to it as well. So there were all of these series that were out during this time. And again, you were time-locked to watch them. You could only watch them when they were on because nobody had a VCR in those days. And, and that's basically the formative stuff from my childhood, a lot of it anyway. Groovy TV series with a lot of imagination, some animated, some marination, some live action, a variation all across the board on a lot of different things. And, well, I think the takeaway here is that the stuff that used the imagination and respected the audience and really went to town and made itself as good as it could possibly be is the stuff that thrived. Just considering the anime stuff. Innovation always comes from the edge of things. It never comes from the mainstream. It comes from the edge. So Japanese animators working with limited resources created an industry that's worth billions of dollars now and delights people across the planet. Irwin Allen tried to redo Lost in Space in 2005 and it died in the arse. That pretty much says it all. The innovation stuff where the respect is there for the audience really thrives. And I think that's the message I'm trying to get across by diving into my childhood here. I'll leave you with another thought too, which is kind of related to media in a lot of ways, and it came up on Facebook and I'm really intrigued by it. And I'd like to hear feedback on this part particularly. There's been a talk on a couple of people's Facebook feeds. Stephen Barnes, a very fine speculative fiction writer who's also a man of colour, started a discussion thread about the emasculation of black characters in cinema and how black characters in mainstream cinema and in genre films very rarely get laid. They don't have any sex life at all. It's almost like they're not supposed to, in a sense. And the question came up about that, and I thought, yeah, that's fair. Cop too. You got to think back to the blaxploitation stuff in the 70s. Black guys got laid a lot in blaxploitation. It's like they've had a drought ever since then. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of internal life, say, the Falcon has in the new Captain America movie, whether they give him a well-rounded character or whether he's just there, kind of like Rhodey is in Iron Man. Or whether they do flesh it out. I mean, if Marvel do a Black Panther movie based on the Black Panther character from the comic books, maybe that'll change, and I do hope it does. But what do people think about that idea of the emasculation of black characters in genre fiction. Anyway, I'm going to finish up with the talk Liz Travascus and I did about The Phantom of the Paradise last Thursday night. And I'll just leave you with that, and then I'll do the feedback.
On 105.7 ABC Darwin, 783 in Alice Springs, Liz Travascus with you this Thursday evening. And if you love movies but you never know what to hire out, it's a situation I find myself in often. Terry Frost is the man who's here to help. I reckon he watches at least, at the very least, 10 films a week. That's more than 500 films a year. Possibly he watches way more than that. And his scope of interest is enormous. Tonight he will introduce you to a B-grade gothic horror musical comedy. But before we get into that, I think we need to reflect briefly on last week's film. Terry, hello.
Hi, Liz.
We spoke last week about, well, what is now my new favourite Australian film, Newsfront, and there's been some sad news since we discussed that film.
There has. Unfortunately, Wendy Hughes died of cancer at the age of 61, not long after we spoke about the movie. And we talked about her role in the film, but she also had a tremendous career on television, in cinema and in theatre, all the way up to about 2012. And it's a sad loss.
Yeah, I believe it was Brian Brown, actually, and Brian Brown, who starred alongside her in Newsfront. He actually announced her passing to an audience at a Sydney Theatre Company show that she might have had some
involvement. Yeah, they were doing Travelling North.
Yeah. So, I wasn't greatly familiar with a lot of her work, although I have seen her, I think, in an ABC TV series more recently. But just having watched that and seen her as a young actress and then hearing that she passed away, only 61 years old. So, quite sad.
Very sad. We do have to mention something else about Newsfront. I said last week that there wasn't a DVD release, and there was. If you look around, you can find copies of Newsfront on DVD.
Great. Maybe not that easy to find. Like, you maybe wouldn't find it if you rocked up to your local sort of music and video retailer. But if you look around online, you can find it. We both had a bit of a look around and found it in a few different places. I know there will be some listeners who will be very glad to hear that, Terry, because we had some inquiries after my enthusiastic review last week about where they could find that film. So, yes.
You do enthusiasm very well.
Well, it's my new favourite Australian film. That film was Newsfront. We have a different film to talk about tonight. Well, Newsfront was filmed in 1978, and we're standing tonight, Terry, with a 1974 creation. The film is Phantom of the Paradise. Take a little listen.
20th Century Fox presents Phantom of the Paradise, a gothic horror story.
What was that?
A beautiful love story. A cinematic odyssey through the rock universe. From Greece to glitter and beyond. The story of a sound, the man who created it, the girl who sang it. The monster who stole it, and the phantom who haunts the paradise, the ultimate rock palace. Phantom of the Paradise.
My music is for Phoenix. Only she can sing it. Anyone else that tries dies.
Phoenix.
You told me one time that you'd be somebody.
And you better get yourself a castrato for this.
Paul Williams as Swan.
And the angels that defeated them.
I want you to stop terrorizing the paradise and rewrite your cantata.
And the Phantom.
Stop from
There really is the Phantom.
Ooh, from 1974, Phantom of the Paradise. Terry, introduce us to the story. What's going on in this film?
It's the story of a music composer called Winslow Leach who goes to the world's biggest record producer, Swan, played by Paul Williams. And Swan likes his music but doesn't like him and doesn't want to pay for the music, so he frames him for a drug-dealing rap and has him put in prison, but he escapes and then trying to get back against Swan. He gets mutilated and becomes the Phantom of the Paradise, Swan's new rock venue.
And this is a film that draws on a number of different stories, isn't it?
It does.
I mean, it's fairly clear in the title there and with the notion of the Phantom that it's drawing on Phantom of the Opera, but what else does it bring in?
The Legend of Faust, you know, Selling Your Soul to the Devil's in there. There's a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe in there. There's all sorts of different mashups, and it really works. I think it's much better than the Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom of the Opera.
Do you really?
Yeah, that's rubbish.
how was Edgar Allan Poe incorporated into this? It wasn't immediately
evident.
Ricking
people up into the wall.
Ah, okay.
When they try to brick him into a wall, it's very much like a kind of Edgar Allan Poe thing. Locking someone behind a brick wall is not a
beating
nice thing.
Beating hearts,
to do.
Trapped in buildings, bodies under the floor, that kind of thing. Okay, yes, Edgar Allan Poe. Unlike last week, where I recognised so many faces and voices, this week I have to admit everyone was unfamiliar to me. Talk to me about who are the stars of this show.
Well, the big star is William Finley, who was a friend of the director Brian De Palma's in university and later went on to teach at that college, theatre and arts. So he's about 6'4". He's got a kind of lazy eye, very geeky-looking guy, really. But I think he works really well as Winslow. He's got the innocence where the innocence matters. He's got the craziness when Winslow goes insane. And I think he does really well. Then you've got Jessica Harper as Phoenix, the singer, whom the Phantom falls in love with. That was her first role, but she's done a number of other things, including Shock Treatment, the sequel to Rocky Horror, which this movie bears a bit of a resemblance to.
Okay, because I wanted to ask about Jessica Harper. She seemed to have a familiarity, and I thought she was really a standout performance in this film. I thought she sang exceptionally well. Was that her singing?
That was her singing voice. She was a singer as well as an actress. And she's done a whole bunch of things. In 2004, she was in Minority Report, the Tom Cruise movie as well, amongst other things. And I really like her. And she was in a really good Peter O'Toole movie called My Favourite Year back in the early 1980s.
Okay. Has she... I got a sense that her face was familiar and maybe she was someone who was quite prominent in film today, but I get the sense that she's not...
No, she did a cookbook recently, I do know that, but she married a studio executive and went on to raise a family, as a number of people do. But I like her from a whole bunch of films that she did in the 70s and 80s, and I think she's got a nice presence that she brings across, the innocence at the start with Phoenix, and then, of course, as she gets into the rock and roll lifestyle and pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
I think she plays
she
it really
changes.
Well. She does change a bit, but this movie is just totally crazy. And Brian De Palma, the director, who also directed things like the Al Pacino Scarface, which is a remake, and The Untouchables, really does have a terrific visual style. There's a beautiful
screen sequence. This was before Scarface and The Untouchables, though. Was it?
It was. It was a very early film of his. He's the guy who discovered Robert
De
Niro.
And who was he when he... I mean, what was happening at the time when he created this film? Was he a known director or was someone taking a bit of a risk on him?
He was an up-and-comer. He did a small movie in Canada, I think it was, called Sisters, which was a very dark horror movie. And on the basis of that, which had a release in Australia and did quite well at the box office for the amount of money it cost to make, he got this film and then moved on and did a movie called Carrie, the original version of that with Sissy Spacek.
Right, so he has had some, he has done some important work. I reckon, Terry, we're going to differ on our critique of this film. I thought it was entertaining, but easily forgettable.
I kind of like
I suspect
music
you have a different feeling.
Yeah, I saw it in the 70s, so I've got that advantage over you on that one. But I kind of like the fact that they mash up a whole bunch of different legends. I don't think it's perfect, and I think there are a couple of weak spots, one of which, in my opinion, is Paul Williams as Swan. I think they should have got somebody a bit more theatrical to play the role. But I kind of like the fact
that... How do you think he did play the role?
He kind of understated. He was too trying to play cool, where what he should have been playing was a bit more Orson Welles, over the top and bombastic and larger than life.
Yeah, I didn't like him. I thought he was creepy, and I couldn't reconcile the irksome feelings that he gave me with all these fawning young ladies throwing themselves at him.
I think he was a bit Phil Spector. I think that was really the thing he was going for there.
Yeah.
Before Phil Spector had his unfortunate experiences, which were even more unfortunate for the woman he shot. But I think there was a bit of Phil Spector thrown in there a bit, where they should have really given him more weight in a sense.
So what about then, what else was in there that, I mean, yep, Phantom of the Opera, yep, some Edgar Allan Poe, yep, some, what else, some Faustian legend of selling your soul to the devil. What else was mashed into there that you liked it? What was that mashup and pastiche that you so loved?
I like the pastiche, the song Upholstery, which is kind of like a Grease type song and a Beach Boys kind of song with some nice pastiche of the Beach Boys style of surf rock in there. I like the glam rock thing with Beef, played by Garrett Graham, in there, who looks a lot like Rocky did in Rocky Horror. There's a weird thing here, because Rocky Horror, the stage play, came out before this film, but I'm not sure how much of it an American director would have seen. There are some parallels, and you can compare the two movies. But I think that they were kind of surfing the same wave at the time, that glam rock thing, the start of punk with some of the costumes and some of the attitudes and things like that. In fact, Daft Punk, the band, when they were teenagers, the two guys in Daft Punk saw this movie 20 or 30 times at the cinema.
No way. Why? 20 or 30 times at the cinema.
They did, Daft and that's Punk. How they got the kind of, yeah, they got the black leather thing and the helmets and all that from Phantom of the Paradise.
From the get-up that he creates to cover his disfigured face.
Yep, and that
oh,
bit
that's
with
a
the,
good that's a good little bit of trivia for throwing around at parties, Terry Frost.
It is a little bit. And record press that disfigures the Phantom, and it's not a spoiler because it's in the trailer, nearly did some damage to William Finley as well. They put a block in to stop the press from shutting entirely on him, and then put some rubber in there to make it look like he was being crushed by a record press. But the block snapped, and he pulled his head away at the last moment and very nearly got himself quite badly damaged in real life.
I want to go back to the music, because it is a musical, and you were just talking about the song that you liked, Upholstery, that sort of had the Beach Boys mashup. Well, not mashup, but the Beach Boys influence sound. The song that I liked was at the beginning of the film, and it has a similar sound to the song that you enjoyed. Let's have a little listen to Goodbye, Eddie.
Started singing when he was five. Never knew his father, mother didn't bother to catch his last name. Fast as he came, he was often flying. Times were really trying. Eddie and his mother alone. Soon another mister, soon a baby sister. Mama kept swinging and Eddie kept singing on.
Maybe not so much Beach Boys, but a little bit more Grease, as you heard in the trailer that they referred to it, travelling from Grease, but not Grease the place, Grease the sound. And I really enjoyed that song, and I did enjoy Upholstery as well. Who was responsible for the music, and how was the musical part of this musical received?
Paul Williams, the guy who played Swan, did the music for it. He was known as a composer. He did songs like You and Me Against the World and just an old-fashioned love song, and We've Only Just Begun, Rainy Days and Mondays. He was very big at the time. He also wrote The Rainbow Connection for Kermit in the Muppet movie.
Paul Williams wrote The Rainbow Connection. And Paul Indeed. Williams is who plays Swan in this film. Okay, painting a bigger picture for me of who this actor and performer is. And how was the music received?
The music was received well. I've actually got a vinyl pressing of it, and I remember seeing lots of them in the record shops at the time. And the music, I think, was received better than the film was. The film didn't do really big business anywhere except Winnipeg in Canada, where it was on midnight cinemas for ages.
That's an odd place to pick out that we know that it did well. Did it? I suspect this is a film that over the years has sort of built a bit of a cult following and has maybe been shown in tandem with the likes of Rocky Horror Picture Show. Is that where it exists in our culture now?
I think it is. It's all part of that 1970s nostalgia thing, because they do talk in the film about how nostalgia is over, even though they've put two or three songs together that are very much harking back to the 1950s and 1960s. But it's in there. There's been a recent release too. They released a new version of it on Blu-ray very recently, because it does have a cult following amongst movie buffs, and it's just something that a lot of people haven't seen, a lot of younger people haven't seen. But it's not a perfect film by any means. I don't think it's got quite the impact that Rocky Horror had, but it's a little bit of fun and it's a bit different, and it's very different from a lot of other things Brian De Palma did.
There was one scene that you wanted to talk about specifically because you said it was brilliant stuff. When I was watching this film, I made a little note for our discussion, which was we need to talk about this particular scene because I hate it. Describe the scene that you wanted to talk about.
Well, there's a split-screen scene where there's a stage car, a fake car that goes out on stage during a musical number, and someone puts a big ticking time bomb into the boot of it, and the split-screen shows from the front of the theatre and from the back of the theatre alongside as the bomb gets put into the car and then pushed out on stage, and they've got two different camera crews filming it all at once. That's a bit of a nod to an Orson Welles film, Touch of Evil, which right at the start has about a 3-minute sequence all in one shot of somebody putting a bomb into the boot of a car and the car moving through a border town. So it's a bit of a nod to movie buffs, that scene.
And you liked that scene because you recognised the nod or because there was something else that you appreciated?
I love the technical expertise that lets them do a couple of a minute long shot from two different viewpoints all at once without one camera seeing the other, or without the audience losing their attention for it. Mm. I kind of like that. It's a bit show-offy, I'll admit. It very much is a bit of a show-off move. But he only does it once, and it's a little bit of fun. And because we're not taking the movie too seriously, we can kind of let a director have a little bit of an indulgence in that sort of thing.
The reason I didn't like it, Terry, is because there was too much going on for me and I didn't know what I was watching. I didn't know which side of the split screen to pay attention to, and I got really muddled up in that moment.
I think the chaos is the point, in a sense. It's a rehearsal for a big stage production that's going to be chaotic, and the audience shares the chaos that's on screen. And the confusion.
I can't help but think if there were a few more million dollars involved in the production of this film, I would have liked it a little bit more as well. Like, I just felt, I don't know, I felt like sound-wise or, I just felt like there was some polishing that needed to have been done around the edges without losing the chaos and without losing the garishness of some of the costumes. I just felt, you know, it feels low budget.
Yeah, it's a bit of a drive-in movie in that sense, and a lot of films of its type and with its kind of budget in the 70s were a bit raw, but it's part of the charm. It's like seeing scratches in an old piece of film stock. You know that the film's a bit raw and a bit rough, but it's just there so that it'll sell popcorn.
There was some good fashion, and the costumes were pretty great. I mean, there's a scene where Phoenix sings for the first time, and I love the get-up that she's in. It's just very fashionable 70s sort of, I think, flares and this kind of big floppy fedora, and she looks really stunning. But the costume for the glam rock scenes, and then there's towards the end where the band is painted up sort of in the Kiss black and white lightning bolt face paint, was that a big element of the film? Was that where a lot of the money went?
I think a lot of the money went in the staging of it. They had entire theatres booked out for months in, I think they filmed it in Texas, and that kind of thing. And the look of those guys with the lightning bolts and that is also another movie homage to the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari for the silent film, the German film from 1924. So there are all these little movie bits and pieces in there, which a lot of people don't get, but they're in there just as a little bit of fun, and some people enjoy it, some people don't.
For the movie buffs like you who know what they're talking about, they're talking directly to you, Terry. Who is this film for? Who will enjoy this film?
Well, it's for me, really, because I'm a movie buff. But people who grew up in the 70s, it's a bit of fun. People who like retro stuff, people who want to see where a lot of the styles and the fashions and the attitudes nowadays came from. And it's always good to go back to primary sources on these things. And also people who like De Palma's other films, just seeing something he did for the fun of it.
Terry, lovely to speak with you again. What film shall we do next time?
We're doing a children's film from 1940, Thief of Baghdad, which is an English film which has got a lot of history to it, and it's just a beautiful old colour film.
That sounds lovely. I look forward to it. Thank you, Terry Frost.
Thank you very much, Liz.
And thank you also to the very knowledgeable texter who has been in touch to say that Paul Williams, who played the role of Swan, who is responsible for all the lyrics and songs and music in Phantom of the Paradise, apparently Paul Williams actually features on Daft Punk's latest album, Random Access Memory, or RAM. How does he feature, anonymous texter? Please tell us more about this, the Paul Williams Daft Punk connection. Because as you heard Terry Frost explaining then, Daft Punk went and saw that film, Phantom of the Paradise, some 20 or 30 times when they were little. The film in which Paul Williams starred. Paul Williams now apparently featuring on Daft Punk's latest album. How? Tell me more. 0487 991 057. Another song that Paul Williams is responsible for, which features on the album, is called Goodbye, Eddie, Goodbye.
We'll remember you forever. Sacrifice you made, we can't believe the price you paid for love. Little Eddie Mitty, born in Jersey City, started singing when he was five. Never knew his father, mother didn't bother to catch his last name. Eddie's sister, Mary Louise, needed an operation. To get the money, he would have to become an overnight sensation. Eddie believed the American people had wonderful, love-giving hearts. His well-publicized end, he considered, would send his memorial album to the top of the charts, and it did. Shock and surprise in a plane crash or a flashy sports car. he becomes quite well known, and the kindness he's shown has made more than one post-mortem star. Well, you did it, Eddie. And though it's hard to applaud suicide, you gave all you could give so your sister could live. All America's choked up inside, man.
Opening number from the film Phantom of the Paradise. It's called Goodbye, Eddie. Goodbye, Liz Travass.
They say the world don't have heroes anymore. Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi there. This is Roger Ward, Fifi for Mad Max, and you're listening to Martian Drive-In. Enjoy, babies.
I always smile when I hear that. Roger's such a lovely person. Sal got me that as a surprise, got Roger Ward to do some promos for the podcast, and says thanks to Sal for that one. On to the feedback. And the feedback we got this time is from Morris from over at Love That Album Podcast. Morris sent me an email at work because we work for the same company. He said, "Hey, Terry, I was listening to your MDIP special discussion of your most anticipated films of 2014. I guess I've always known this, but your podcast made one fact all too apparent. There is far too much dramatic, reverb-heavy percussion in modern movie trailers. The template is usually sinister chord, serious line of dialogue, heavy reverberating percussion, another line of serious dialogue, more heavy reverb percussion, two people yelling, music build up then stop suddenly, no music while characters utter some line in the realm of shit just got real, minor chord music starts with more heavy percussion which keeps building dramatically until the climax when the chords played at the start fades away. I'm sure there are variations, but this is the template and it annoys the crap out of me. Otherwise, really digging the show. You and Paul have great rapport. That's all. Cheers, Morris." Thanks for that, Morris. I noticed that a bit too when I was putting together the trailer bits to interstitially put in between the bits that Paul and I talked about. And yeah, they do get a little bit like that. It's kind of like it was 15, 20 years ago when it was all starting with "In a World" kind of stuff. They do get a bit cliched, and getting trailers that break out of that mold is probably the way to go now. I really should go over to the Apple trailers and just watch a bunch of them to see whether it's consistent across genres or whether it's a trope that's particular to genre films. So romantic comedies usually start with bouncy music, as do some other comedies. So there are probably templates there for the sound design on trailers as much as there are for the visuals as well. But thanks for that, Morris. And you being a musician, you've got a particular ear for that kind of thing. So that feedback is very, very welcome. And people should go and listen to anything you turn your hand to. Love That Album in particular. So that's about it for the feedback now. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Rob Jan and I will be doing the DC Cinematic Universe. I've got him lined up to have a chat about that, and we'll be throwing lots of that together, going all the way back from probably the Fleischer Superman cartoons all the way through to Man of Steel at the very least. I'm probably talking about versus Superman as well. So that's next time around, and I'm looking forward to having that chat with Rob, and I'm sure he will drop some very, very, very bad puns into it. So in the meantime, watch the skies, look after yourselves, and I'll be back in a fortnight. Bye.